and you do neuroscience? Isn't that what biologists do? So anyway, normally in this part of the talk, you give this big long list of all the things that he did and why he's so important and famous. But actually, I don't know that much about John other than the fact that he's a good friend of mine, and I'm really glad he's here. So we're going to have, about a 45-minute talk or so?
Yeah.
Keep it reasonably short, because we're going to have as long a question and answer session as you're able to put up with. So last chance to pick up on some food in the next couple minutes and drinks. And we'll give the stage to John.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad that you came. You couldn't have all come for the food, so hopefully you're here for the talk. Is it okay if I dim this? Is that going to be fine? Or is that going to, hopefully, you'll do it? Okay. What? Oh, okay. Hopefully that'll turn on too. Well, wonderful. Okay, so as Dr. Oakes said, I am a physicist who likes to study the brain, and this is increasingly becoming a topic where these two fields merge. And the topic that I'm going to speak to you today about is neuroscience, is there room for the soul, particularly modern neuroscience. I like to start out with this picture because it makes the brain look like it's a big chunk of meat. And when it's a big chunk of meat, you don't naturally think of the soul being in there. You kind of think of the brain as being this material object, and it's got nothing ethereal going on in it. But maybe there is something in there, because we all tend to think that we're important and that maybe we've got something going on inside of us that's a little bit more than just molecules rubbing together. So let's talk about that in more detail. Here's what I'm going to tell you. First, I'm going to lay a little bit of the background in terms of the philosophy of this conflict between pure materialism and then some view of science that allows for something else to exist, like a soul or like God or like free will. So there are these two views that are coming into conflict, and it's playing out all the time. And neuroscience is one of the battlegrounds of this particular conflict. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit about background of neuroscience, because even though we all have neurons, we might not know how they work, right? So we want to know how these little brain cells work, how do they talk to each other, just give you sort of enough of a background to kind of understand the other points that I'll get into. And then I'll talk about these three topics: free will, ethics, and God. And how these two views, the materialist view and sort of the beyond materialist view, clash on these three points. And then we'll try to see, well, actually, you guys will decide for yourselves. I'm not going to try to sway you one way or the other, but probably by the end you'll realize that I am biased a little bit, and hopefully you'll forgive me for that. All right, so let's go into it. Introduction. All right. The Greeks thought, well, the sun, how does the sun get across the sky? Well, clearly there's this big chariot, and Apollo drags it across the sky, and there he is, you know, his chariot, his horses. But now we know that this is a silly story, because we know that the earth rotates, right? So the earth rotates, and as the earth rotates, that makes it look like the sun is rising in the east and setting in the west. So science killed Apollo. Will modern neuroscience also kill the soul? Will it kill free will? Will it kill God? Will it kill ethics? Will we go beyond good and evil, as Nietzsche said, if we really understand how everything works? So here's the root of the philosophical clash. In the beginning, well, not really in the beginning, but this is one of the first views that was really articulated. Descartes, who brought you things like Cartesian geometry that might be painful for you, but one of the things that he also did was he said, look, there's this difference between the material world and something outside of the material world. There's mind and body. And what he thought was, oh, look, it looks like these rays of light are all focusing on this one part, the pineal gland. This is sort of like the saddle of consciousness. So somewhere riding on the pineal gland is your soul or your mind. And so one way to kind of visualize this picture is this. You've got a body, but driving it is this little thing somewhere outside. It's not material. It's the mind. And somehow your mind is affecting your brain, and that affects your body. And so there's this dualist idea. There are two things going on. There's a brain and there's a mind. And so with this viewpoint, you say that body and mind are separate, and mind will influence body, but the ultimate truth is mind. Somehow mind is the most important thing. And Descartes was a rationalist, so he strongly believed that the mind was the most important thing. Now, the modern view that most neuroscientists embrace today is this: monism. In contrast to dualism, monism says there's only one thing going on, and that one thing is the brain. And the mind is just a byproduct of the brain. So the brain is this wonderful organ. It's very complex, but what it produces is somehow the mind, the thing that we call the mind. And all things that we think are interesting, in a way, flow from this organ. So this is the one of the proponents of this view, Antonio Damasio. But in truth, any of the 30,000 neuroscientists that are descending on San Diego starting tomorrow will probably be more likely to be monists than dualists. So it's currently the reigning viewpoint. But not everyone, including some people in this room, don't believe in it. Now, here's the conflict. So dualism would say, yeah, you could have a God who would exist independently of the mind, and maybe free will exists independently of our brains, and maybe ethics is something we should investigate philosophically, and it's not just rooted in our minds. Maybe ethics actually exists out there somewhere. What is right and wrong might be a topic that's independent of how our brains are built. But people who are monists would say, no, 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 wait a minute. God is a figment of the imagination, as is your free will, and what is right and wrong is only a matter of social convention or something that you learned. It's coded in your synapses. Somehow your synapses in your brain are just telling you what these things are, but they don't objectively exist outside of your brain. It's just that chunk of meat that I showed you in the beginning paragraph, or the beginning slide. That's all there is to. So hopefully you get from this the idea of the conflict. I'm setting the stage for what the conflict is. So now, let's go a little bit into neuroscience. These are some of the basic points of how the brain is thought to be constructed, what it works on. Now, neuroscience is trying to explain the brain on many different levels. So one of the levels that I would call microscopic is looking at individual brain cells. So this is a brain cell that I filled with a fluorescent dye when I was a graduate student. It took me much pain and suffering to produce this picture, so I show it with great pride. Many tears and much gnashing of teeth went into that. So you can study how individual brain cells behave, or how synapses, the contacts between these brain cells, behave as well. Or you can even study biochemistry that's involved in neurotransmitters. That's the microscopic level. But what we'd like to do is relate the microscopic level up into the macroscopic level. Somehow we'd like to be able to explain how we can, you know, look at some pattern here, and if I put your head in a brain scanner, I see this part of your brain light up. That's the visual part. Unless you were a Vulcan and maybe some other part of your brain lights up. But as long as you're human, that would go there. So we can study how the gross properties, the macroscopic properties, are working, and we somehow try to link these by this middle property, the mesoscopic level, meso means middle, of networks of brain cells. So somehow these individual guys get together and form networks, and these networks then form regions that are devoted to specific tasks, like vision. So most people don't believe that a single brain cell really can do a whole heck of a lot. But when you get a bunch of them together, they can do things like recognize faces, they can store information, they can compute, and stuff like that. And then when you put a whole bunch of them devoted to certain tasks together, then you get a whole brain region that'll do something like interpret language or see things. This is a very gross picture of it, very rough sketch. So let's build up. So this is a zoom in on one of these neurons. As you look in closer, and this isn't as good as the pictures that we can get today. This was taken back in like 1993 or 4. You can see perhaps little tiny bumps on here. Well, there are about 10,000 bumps on one of these brain cells. And each one of those little bumps is forming what's called a synaptic spine, and that's where it receives inputs from lots of other brain cells. So there are about 10 to the 10th neurons in the human brain. So that's a pretty big number. Now, how do these neurons talk to each other? What signals do they send? They have little voltage pulses. And so if I were to stick an electrode into one of these neurons, a little tiny electrode, and then amplify the signal, when this neuron wants to talk to other neurons, what it does is it sends a little voltage pulse. So you can imagine if I had a rope, and if I kind of quickly snapped the rope, a little pulse would travel along. That's kind of what happens. These neurons send voltage pulses that travel down axons. And they go from one neuron through a synapse into another. And so you can have a chain of these things talking to one another. And right here, these synapses, sometimes these synapses can get bigger. When you learn something repeatedly, that synapse will grow. And when you don't do something, like you don't do your homework, your synapses will shrink. And then what happens is you forget things. So if you continually do one thing over and over again, these synapses will get bigger and you'll learn it. But if you don't do it, these synapses will get smaller. And so learning and memory is thought to take place at these synapses because they direct the flow of information through these neural networks. So if you make some of them stronger, then preferred paths will be established. If you make some of them weaker, then other pathways that might have been there before are turned off. So that might have to do with learning and memory. And this is a highly parallel network, as I've alluded to before. You get about, you know, anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 inputs coming into a given neuron, and it makes about as many outputs as it sends projections to other neurons, sending voltage pulses to them. So it's a very parallel network. Now, what an individual neuron does is it behaves a little bit kind of like a threshold device. It'll take all the inputs within a given point of time, and then it will say, do I have more than my threshold? Maybe it says, I need to have 100 inputs within 1 second. And if 100 inputs come in within 1 second, then it will go, okay, now I'm going to send out a pulse of my own. But if it doesn't receive 100 inputs within 1 second, then it won't send out a pulse. So all the inputs have to go over a threshold, and then it will send out an output. So otherwise, it won't send a signal out. So here's a little movie taken from a neuron in the cat's visual area. So a cat is sitting in an apparatus, and they're shining a light in front of the cat, and they've got an electrode poked into one of the brain cells in the back of the cat's head where it processes visual information. And as this object is moved back and forth, what you're going to see is these little voltage pulses going straight up and down. They're like vertical lines. And they, hopefully if this sound is hooked up, well, you probably can't hear it. You see these vertical lines right here? Those things are voltage pulses that are caused by something moving in the cat's visual field. And so this is just giving you an idea. This is a real recording done by a guy who's actually on my thesis committee. And now what these guys do is when you get lots of these things together, you put these two guys giving inputs to this. If this has a threshold of 2, let's just say it requires 2 inputs before it spits something out, then that means the only way this is going to give an output is if this one's on and this one's on. This one alone is not enough, and that one alone is not enough. Both of them have to be on for this to give an output. And so if that's true, then this thing will behave like a logical AND gate. And a logical AND gate is one of the fundamental units of computing that you find in all computers. So this thing would behave as an AND gate if it's got a threshold of 2. Now, if I change it and I make it only have a threshold of 1, all it needs is 1 to go off, then this will behave like an OR gate. Either this one or that one or both of them will cause this one to fire. And so by setting the threshold differently, we can make it either an AND gate or an OR gate, and then you can also have NOT gates. And with these fundamental units, you can build any kind of computer you want. So the brain can be made to do all kinds of computations, even though sometimes we don't feel like it. We can make it do any computation. It's got the equipment for it. So now when you put a whole bunch of these guys together, they form a network that can do computations. So this is a section of the cortex, and I'll tell you what that is in a little bit more. And one of these sections, it's about 1 to 2 millimeters thick. And one of these sections is just this outer layer of the brain. What is this walnut-looking thing? If you took a big axe and kind of chopped my head right in half right now, a bunch of people would scream, but then you'd pull this off, and what you'd see is this little walnut-shaped thing. And that walnut-shaped thing would be a cross-section of my brain. And the outside of it is the bark. And Latin in bark is cortex. And so the cerebral cortex is really just the bark of the brain. It's the outer wrinkly gray matter that's only 1 to 2 millimeters thick. And this is the stuff that has rapidly expanded as you go up the phylogenetic tree. So the poor little mouse has about a postage stamp worth of cortex. As you go up to something like a squirrel monkey, maybe you've got an index card. Chimps, they're impressive. They have a whole sheet of paper. But we really blow the doors off the chimps because we've got 4 sheets of paper. So if you were to take all your brain and kind of unfold the cortex, it would be about the size of a big pizza. Now, why don't we have more? Well, the problem is childbirth, right? I mean, we can't fit more and more cortex in here without wrinkling it more and more. And then, you know, as I witnessed as my wife gave birth to our first child, that's a brutal process, right? So you can't make the head too much bigger without, like, blowing your pelvis apart. So you can only fit so much in there. So this is about as good a job as you can do with all the infolding and wrinkling. The reason you can't go in anymore is because this stuff, this white matter, is the cabling. This is all the wires leading from one cortical area to the other. And that's really important, too. If you cut that up, then you can't play bridge either. But you need the cortex and you need the white matter. So we're packing about as much as we possibly can into the head. And even then, we're packing more, right? Because when a baby's born, their head comes out like cone-shaped, right? And then afterwards, it snaps back. And so we're already passing the limit of the birth canal. So anyway, cortex is vital for higher cognitive functions. So what's going on in cortex? Well, we've got these neural networks. They have little AND gates, and they have synapses that change, and that's how learning and memory goes. And just to tell you briefly about the work that we do in my lab, this is a little piece of brain that we've cultured. You can take it out of a rat, and once you take it out of a rat, you can put it on a little tiny electrode array, and you can keep it alive for about 4 weeks if you give it the right amount of hormones and salts and sugars and oxygen. You keep it happy, and as far as we can tell, it thinks it's still in the brain. The joke's on it, and it's still computing away, and it produces these little voltage pulses. There you see them, kind of vertical lines. And whenever one of those guys crosses the threshold, we can mark it as a blue dot. So here's a really brief movie of activity from one of those little slices of brain. We can record these things for like 7 hours at a time, so we get tons and tons of data. After 1 hour, we have to pull out a 300 gigabyte drive and then stick another one in, and we love it. When we travel, we have to like take big crates of these 300 gigabyte drives, and they always ask us at the airport, why are you doing this? So anyway, it's a lot of fun. I love this kind of research. And if you have questions about particular things that we do, feel free to ask that. But I just wanted to let you know kind of where I fit in this whole picture. Okay, now back to cortex. Now cortex is parcelated into different areas or regions that have particular functions. Now, this isn't strictly speaking true, but it's largely true. And so it's a decent approximation of what goes on. This is the front right here. The eyeball would be right around here. This is the back of your head. And roughly speaking, this line down the middle, this thing called the central sulcus, divides the brain between sensation, everything back here is involved in some kind of sensory process, and action. Everything up here is involved in some kind of decision making or motor movement or something like that. So back here, you've got visual areas. You've also got hearing in here. Things up here tell you where a visual object is. Things down here tell you what kind of object you're looking at, and you make sense of sounds here. And up here are things like decisions that you make, and here is moving your arms and legs and tongues and fingers and things like that. So the brain is kind of parcelated in these regions. So if you have damage to one part of the brain, then sometimes you lose one of these functions that's mapped out here. So how do we understand what's going on in the brain? There's lots of different ways of doing it. One way is by getting paid by researchers, like $200 an hour when I was a graduate student. I'd sign up for all the studies I could, right, because I was tired of eating ramen noodles. So you get these things, and you can get an EEG. This is measuring the electric field through the skull. So that's one way of getting it, and it produces these kinds of waveforms here, and we can interpret these things based on what the waveforms are. Activity through the skull. And then another way of looking at things is use something called a PET scan, positron emission tomography. So they'll have you drink something that's radioactive, and this stuff will go into your brain depending on what you're thinking about. And certain parts of your brain will take up more of this radioactive glucose than others. And so I guess this is some kind of task, some verbal task, and when somebody's not practiced, different parts of their brain light up, and when they practice this task, then it will focalize into one area. So this is one way of sort of measuring brain activity, so glucose metabolism. And the way that gets the most press these days is fMRI. It's called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And at this conference this week, this will be talked about a ton. And so what people do is, you can sit inside a scanner, and I've sat inside one, and it's, you know, this really tiny little tube that you're in, and it makes a loud clanging noise. And they say, don't worry about the clanging noise, just think about this image that I'm flashing in front of your head. And while you do that, basically what they do is they subject your brain to large magnetic fields, and they can interpret where the blood is going, because blood's got iron in it. And iron can be picked up by magnetic fields going on and off. And then they can determine what areas of your brain are using oxygen because the blood flows there. And so, yeah, this determines the blood oxygen level dependent responses. So you can kind of make inferences about what parts of the brain are being used under this condition, under this task. And then finally, this is the last neuroscience slide I'm going to do before we get into free will, ethics, and God. Transcranial magnetic stimulation. You can take a very large magnet and put it close to your brain and put a massive pulse through it. Sounds like fun, right? So what it does is it induces a big magnetic field, and because of something called Lenz's law, this causes all kinds of currents to flow in your head to oppose this magnetic field. And as these currents flow through your head, they flow through your brain cells, and they cause weird sensations. And I'll talk about this a little bit more later. In some people, it produces the sensation of God. We'll talk about this. So as you can see, it's not a very precise thing. It's stimulating a very broad area of cortex. Okay, now let's talk about free will. Now that you're sufficiently educated in neuroscience to at least critique me, or, you know, contradict me or make fun of me once I tell you this other stuff. All right, so now let's talk about free will. So free will is thought to be one of these sacred things, right? We all have free will. If I don't have free will, then what am I? I'm just some automaton, and I don't want to live anymore. So let's see if we really do have free will. Okay, this is an interesting quote. Every physical system that has been investigated has turned out to be either deterministic or random. Both are bad news for free will, he said. So if human actions can't be caused and aren't random, he said, it must be what? Some weird magical power? Now, I must admit, when I first read this, it's very compelling. It's like, yeah, you're right. What is free will? I mean, gosh, it's got to be either random, like rolling the dice, and that's what makes me decide to, you know, go to the convenience store or not. Or it's some kind of deterministic thing. It's because my wife said, go to the convenience store and pick up new diapers. That's why I'm going. So it's either determined by some external force, or it's determined by internal random processes. But then think about this. So if you were a caveman, and I came to you, and I said, I've got this new stuff. I call it tungsten. Now you're a caveman. Every spear tip you've ever seen is either made out of flint or bone. That's all that's in your mental landscape. You can't conceive of anything else. Flint or bone. Flint or bone. You know? And so I come to you with a tungsten spear tip, and I go, look, what is it? Well, you're going to be tempted to think it's some kind of variation of tungsten, or it's some variation of bone. But you're not going to really be too open to the possibility that it might really be a new material that you've never seen before, right? So anyway, this is something that I want to say is, in many of these discussions about whether free will or God or any of these other things exist, there is an underlying set of assumptions that you ought to question at the very beginning. And at the very beginning, I would say, if we're really going to be scientists about this, we ought to be willing to admit that there might be stuff out there that we don't really know about yet. Maybe. Possibly. At least, let's keep that option open. Okay, so that's one of the things. So now, here's what a dualist would say. A dualist who believes that there's spirit and there's mind, mind and then body, and they're two different things. Free will could exist, perhaps independently of some of our mental processes. Maybe free will is some kind of thing in there. Who knows, that we don't fully understand. But a monist would say, no, free will is definitely produced just by our brain, and in fact, the idea that you feel like you have free will, maybe that's just an illusion. So let's take a look at the experiments that talk about this. So here is one of the most interesting experiments that I think has been done in a long time. So Benjamin LeBay, I don't know exactly how to pronounce his last name, but here's what he did. He took people and he wired them up. He had a way of measuring potentials through the skull, and he also had a way of measuring the muscle potential in their arm. And he said, let's do a real simple experiment. You look at the clock as this second hand is going around, and you tell me when you decide to move your finger. Tell me when you've made the decision, and just note it. At what point was the finger, was the second hand on the clock, when you decided you were going to move your finger. And then we'll match that up with when your brain had some kind of electrical potential that said you were about to move, and when your muscle, in fact, experienced the move. And so here's the result of his experiment. So, this is the willing judgment. This is when he willed things to happen. This is when he thought he started moving. And this is when movement actually occurred. So if we look at the willing judgment, it occurs here. Here's when when he thought he started moving his finger, and here's when it actually started moving, because you've got an electrode on the muscle. And so here's when it actually started moving. So he thought he started moving it here. Well, that's great, but look at this signal here. This signal is coming from the skull, and this is telling us something about the potential in the brain, the electric potential in the brain. This electric potential in the brain is beginning to rise even before this person thought they were making a decision. That's weird. So another way of plotting it is like this. This is really essentially the same graph. This is what he called the readiness potential. Here's when the decision was made, and here's when they actually moved their finger. So people think they're making a decision about here, and there's actually some evidence in the brain that you're about to make your decision, 300 milliseconds before you say you made your decision. It's like there's something going on in your head that's I can read out. Before you even know it, I know what you're going to do. If I hook up your brain to this machine, I know when you're about to move your finger before you do. That's weird, right? And so you thought you were deciding things, but the decision was already made by that point. And so a facile conclusion you could make from this is that there is no such thing as free will. Maybe, but not so fast. Why not something like this going on? There's something called will that we're not able to measure with an electrode. We don't have access to, and maybe we don't fully understand it yet. I don't know. But perhaps. And what that thing does is it sets off the hand movement, and somehow it gets things in motion so that there's activity in the brain that will precede a movement of the hand. And then, at some later time, though, because for some reason this is delayed, you have some notion that you were about to make a decision. You become aware of the fact that you just decided something. You're reflecting back on your decision. And perhaps this occurs later in time than this did. And what could be going on is something like this. This is the pre-potential or the readiness potential, that signal that you get from the brain. And what's going on down here is this is when you actually say, I have decided. And so what's going on is these things are just, they've got different delays going on. It's not that one actually occurs before the other. There might be a delay. So it could be that this is going on. Now, is there any evidence that this is a reasonable hypothesis? Are there any examples of our awareness lagging behind what our brain is actually doing? Well, let me give you one example. Something called blindsight. So you can have people who have particular lesions or damage to certain parts of their brain. A lot of this comes about through fencing accidents. You know, when you put that little foil on your head and everyone says, oh, don't worry, it's safe. You know, someone's going to shoot this thing through you. Occasionally they do have holes. And neuroscientists are very grateful for those holes because it allows the sword to go right through and puncture usually a certain part of the brain and kill it. And then we can find out what's going on with that person. Now, I would never wish this on anybody, but now that it's happened, we're glad to have them come in and we'll check them out. So once these things happen, then you can find out what happened when that little part of the brain was destroyed, that specific part of the brain. And so the other thing that happens is there are bar fights. So it turns out that pool cues can also do similar types of damage if they're properly handled. So what happens here is this guy has something called blindsight. And this is just a cartoon of it, of course, but this really exists. So people will flatly deny that they can see anything. I can't see this. I don't know what this is. What am I eating? Right? They don't know. But then the scientists will say, just take a guess at what you're looking at. And the guy says, well, let me just guess. I see a teapot with white spots. And there are ways of verifying whether they're actually seeing something or not. You know, you can give them some task that's usually 50-50. If they score greater than 50-50, then we know that they've got some information, even though they deny that they've got information about it. How could this happen? How could it be that their brain is doing something that they flatly deny is going on? Well, here's one way it could go on. Here's a vastly oversimplified map of the visual system. It looks like a London subway diagram. But basically down here is something called primary visual cortex. And this is the region that might be lesioned in blindsight. But as you can see, there are lots of other pathways that you can go through the brain. And if that part is lesioned, you can still make an end around or go around this way or who knows what, right? And get the information into the brain, even though it might not happen to go through this area, which is where you become most aware of it. So it'll get there somehow, and you'll be able to answer the question about what's presented in front of you, even though your conscious awareness, which might only access at this point, is damaged. So there are cases where you can actually have recognition without feeling like you've recognized something. So conscious awareness can come after recognition. Also, and here's, maybe this is too much, this is just a bunch of verbal arguments. A lot of low-level processes are often automatic, right? I don't know if you've ever had this happen. You're really, really tired, but you know you got to drive many miles, and you just drive and drive, and then next thing you know, you're getting out of the car, and you go, how did I get here? It's like you're driving automatically in your sleep. There's lots of stuff that we do that's nearly automatic, right? Lots of low-level processes. So do these low-level processes really reflect my will, or are they something else that's going on that maybe we measure with electrodes and so forth, but that doesn't really, it's not the same thing as my will. Let me elaborate slightly more. Here's something really interesting that illustrates this point, and I think everybody should take this test. So I'll leave the slides with Dr. Oakes afterwards, and you can get this website if you can't get it right now. So they've got this thing called the implicit association test. And what they do is they show pictures of different faces, and then they ask you to sort them. And you can sort them in many different ways, right? And it turns out that it's easy enough, at least when I took the test, for me to sort faces in different ways as they come up randomly. I can sort, everything's fine. But what happens when you do this? Now I've got to sort a particular racial group and a type of attribute. So now there are words that pop up. Is laughter a good word or is it an evil word? And I'm European American. So what happens is, and this is just rooted in me, I have this natural tendency, I don't like it, but it's in me, I can naturally sort laughter to this direction faster if it says European American or good. I'm really good at that task. But when we put good over there in any other ethnic group, I'm not as good. What does that mean? It means I'm prejudiced. And I invite all of you to take it, and let's see if you're prejudiced or not. But almost all of us exhibit some level or degree of prejudice for our own group and against other groups. That's interesting. And they have proof of it, right? They have proof of it by reaction times. You react faster to associate good things with your own group than you do to associate good things with another group. It takes you just a microsecond longer, maybe a few milliseconds longer, but it's a statistically significant and consistent difference. We have deep-rooted little tendencies. Now, does that reflect who I am as a person? Some might argue, yes, it does. Others might say, wait a minute, no. It's how you deal with that that reflects who you really are as a person. And I hope it's the latter that really counts. All right, so here we have it. My tendencies could be detected by electrodes or the questions that you ask me, right? But I don't necessarily act on all my tendencies, right? For example, it might be really hard for me to forgive someone. I'm angry at them, but I can choose to forgive them. And I would argue that me suppressing my natural tendency is a more willful act than me giving in to my natural tendency. At least I'll offer that for the discussion afterwards. All right, so which takes more willpower? To be angry or to forgive? And what is a better reflection of will? And when we really study free will, what should we be studying? Should we be studying me moving my finger or maybe something else like my decision to marry Sarah Huberty, or my decision to vote a certain way in the presidential election, or my decision to have a certain religious affiliation? I would argue that those are probably more characteristic of free will than some low-level process like that. I just offer that for you to ponder and consider and argue with me about. I invite that. All right, so free will may be some new type of process, not yet fully understood. Signals or intentions may come before my sense decision, but my choice may actually come before both. That's one option. And the other thing is, we may have strong automatic tendencies, but I might have something called will, which allows me to overrule this. All right, let's go into ethics. So this is a quote from Michael Gazzaniga, who's sort of the high priest of neuroethics. The examination of how we want to deal with the social issues of disease, normality, mortality, lifestyle, and the philosophy of living informed by our understanding of the underlying brain mechanisms. So we have to understand how the brain works in order to decide these things. Let me tell you a story about Phineas Gage that illustrates ethics. So here's a guy back in the 1800s before we had OSHA and all kinds of regulations. What they used to do is they used to like make these railroads by tamping dynamite down into cracks. And this guy had a big long rod, and his job, probably not a good job, was to pack the dynamite way down so it blew up lots of stuff so they could clear the railway. And what do you know? He tapped a little too hard one day. And so what happened is the rod went through his head. So before the rod went through its head, Phineas was known as a very, on-time guy. He was very respectful of people. He had good manners. He didn't have a foul mouth. And lots of other good things about him. This is a reconstruction of kind of where the rod was thought to go. What it did is it basically blew out a part of his prefrontal cortex. And this prefrontal cortex is thought to be important for making moral decisions. And what do you know, after Phineas lost his prefrontal cortex, he was not the same guy. So he became foul-mouthed, he was late, he was not responsible, he couldn't hold a job, he liked to urinate in public. So he was basically someone who, if he was your brother, you might not want to be seen with him that much anymore, although you'd still invite him to Thanksgiving, but you put him in the corner. So now, Phineas was different. So what can we conclude from this? Clearly the health of our brain does affect our ability to make moral choices, right? If a rod went through my head, maybe I'm not going to make the same decisions tomorrow as I did today. But now, here's a separate question. Should we look to the brain to tell us what's right and wrong? That might be a different question. Well, if you're a dualist, you'd say not necessarily. Right and wrong might exist independently of my brain. Right and wrong might be out there somewhere. But if you're a monist, you would say, no, right and wrong is in here. It's all in here. So here's a paper that discusses that. An fMRI, this is one of those magnet scanning things, investigation of emotional engagement and moral judgment. Now here's the dilemma that they gave people. And this is, I think, very interesting. So you got a trolley, it's coming down a track. And this trolley is going to run over one guy and kill him for sure. And you don't know anything about this guy. You don't know if he's an Indianapolis Colts fan or if he's a Chargers fan. Okay? He's just a person as far as you can. So you've got no bias against him. He's just some person. And it's going to kill this family of five. But then there's this guy over here. Now, if it's going to kill that family of five, would you flip the switch so that it would definitely kill this guy but definitely save these people? Most people would say, yeah, I'll flip the switch, of course. It's a simple decision. You're going to save more lives, regardless of knowing anything about the nature of the people, right? But now here's a different... Okay, most people hit the switch, saving five. Here's a different dilemma. So this is called the footbridge dilemma. And so now the trolley is screaming down the track. It's going to kill the family of five. And there you are on the bridge with another person who you could push off, who would kill, you know, that would kill them, right? But it would stop the trolley in a messy way, but it would save these people, all right? So what do you think most people do here? Most people say, I'm not going to do it. No. I want to save the family, but I'm not a murderer. So they refrain from pushing and they let the five people die. That's what most people do. And so moral ethicists have a real tough time with this. They go, why are people not systematic like us professors are? And so they think, we're smart. Why are people doing these dumb things? And professors are known to have these attitudes, okay? So what they did is they said, okay, let's scan the brain. Let's see how it's responding in these two different ways. So here, the emotional areas light up during the footbridge dilemma, when you have problems pushing the guy off the bridge. But during the other dilemma, just the switch, when you're trying to determine whether you're going to kill one person or five people, cognitive areas. These are just calculating areas. These are sappy emotional areas that light up. Okay? So that's one of the things that they found. And this is a really big paper, got lots of citations. Tons of people are talking about it. And I agree. I think it's very interesting. Now, they went a little bit further. They said, let's investigate these two different types of thinking, the emotional thinking and the calculating thinking. So let's say you've got a bunch of soldiers who are approaching and you guys are hiding out and you've got some baby who's crying and crying and crying and you think, you know, all of us were going to live if I can just suffocate this baby. Okay? And then some people wouldn't do that, right? Now here you get a split. You get some people who say, yes, suffocate the baby. No, don't suffocate the baby. And what they find... And so, well, let me classify these people. Deontologists are people who believe that there are absolute moral principles. And so they will never suffocate a baby under any conditions. And utilitarians are people who basically say, let's save the largest number of people, or let's make the largest number of, you know, optimize pleasure, maximize it, minimize pain. And it turns out that the deontologists have all their emotional areas light up. All these people who believe in absolute principles have all their emotional stuff go up, but the people who are utilitarians, who are cold and calculating, I shouldn't inject cold, that's my bias, I'm sorry, retract that, strike it from the record. So, but the utilitarians say, go ahead and smother, their cognitive areas light up. Interesting. So now here's where they have an interesting conclusion. They wrote a review of their own work. And they said, the socioeconomic responses that we've inherited from our primate ancestors undergird the absolute prohibitions that are central to deontology. In contrast, the moral calculus that defines utilitarianism is made possible by more recently evolved structures in the frontal lobes that support abstract thinking and high-level control. So if you want to save that baby, you're not really being abstract and you're not really being high-level. So, in the beginning, when we described the first dilemma, the footbridge versus the switch dilemma, they were just telling us how the brain was responding. But now, it seems to me, and you can judge for yourself, that they're leaning towards telling us what we ought to do based on activity that they interpret in the brain. So it seems like they're suggesting that the right thing to do is the thing that is being told to us by our more advanced parts of our brain, the cognitive stuff, which is go ahead, smother the baby. The more recently evolved parts of your brain are telling you to smother the baby. Go with the flow, man. You've evolved to this higher organism. Go ahead, use it. You know? So, if they are correct, then that means utilitarianism is correct and deontology is wrong. It also means that Joshua Green should give up his federal funding because we can feed more people if we take away his grant money. Now my bias is really showing. Okay, so anyway, but really, I mean, if you're being a utilitarian, and then it also means that intellectual superiority equates with moral superiority. That if you're smarter, then you're more often morally correct. I don't think that's true. Okay, now let's go to God. Does God exist? Big question. Hopefully we all think about this at least once in our life. Okay, dualist. A God could exist independently of our thoughts or whatever our brain is doing. That's possible. A monist. God is all in your mind. It's all a big piece of meat, and it's just telling you that something's out there when it might not be. All right. So here was one of the guys who had an interesting theory of God, a psychologist at Princeton named Julian Jaynes. He wrote this interesting book that I read, and basically he says this, that primitive man had lots and lots of illusions about God talking to him. You know, this guy's mythology is derived from primitive hallucinations where one hemisphere of the brain was not yet fully connected to the other hemisphere. And so what happened is this hemisphere kind of said something, and the other hemisphere interpreted it as the voice of God. And so before these two hemispheres were fully connected, you would think that you were hearing these voices and you would ascribe that to God. So if you think God is talking, that's just your other hemisphere that's saying something to you. Now, as humans evolved, the corpus callosum, which is this data bus that connects the two hemispheres, got thicker, we became more in touch with our other hemisphere, and we're less prone to believe those types of illusions. That's his idea. So here's another interesting thing. Temporal lobe epilepsy. So the temporal lobe, it's this part of your brain that's right sort of beneath your ears, right through here. When you have electrical seizures there, or you have damage in that area of the brain, then what that can produce sometimes is religious hallucinations. And it will also, in some cases, increase ritual behavior. You want to make sure that everything's clean. You want to make sure that you pray. You want to make sure that you don't sin. You want to make sure that everything's, you know, just right. So damage to that part of the brain can create this kind of behavior. So here's a particular example. A certain person, just an example, I'm not trying to harp on one particular group. She suffered a brain injury at age 9 that totally changed her personality. She began to have powerful religious visions after that point. Interesting. Okay. Increased ritual behavior is what I said. All right, so here's a guy, Michael Persinger, and what he found was that if you take one of those magnetic coils and you bring it close to a person's brain and you stimulate it, it can create the sensation that there's a presence nearby, that there's something near you. And some people would even say it's a religious feeling. They feel like God is near. Somehow they sense the presence of God if you've got this coil kind of stimulating your brain there. That's very interesting. And often it occurs when you put it over the temporal lobe, that area. What's going on there? So here's a little clip from some discussion of that work. Scientists like Andrew Newberg want to see just what happens during moments of faith. He worked with Buddhist Michael Baim to study the brain during meditation. By injecting radioactive tracers, PET scans that we talked about before, into Michael's bloodstream as he reached the height of a meditative trance, he could use a brain scanner to image the brain at a religious climax. Now, one of the things that I want to point out here is that very often scientists tend not to be religious, and I think they can have certain narrow views of religious experience. And one of the things I want to point out here is that during moments of faith or during a religious climax. So if this were really all there were to varieties of religious experience, then religion would be a punctate event. It would be like I'm walking along and then, oh, I was religious just there, and now I'm not. So that's a particularly narrow view of religion, I would say. So maybe it's only something that happens once in a while, and you don't want to do it in public, that's for sure. Okay, now, Michael Persinger also has a friend who likes to, you know, hey, I'm all for capitalism. So you can buy the 8-coil Shakti to do this in your own home, designed for intense altered states. The 8-coil Shakti alternates the magnetic stimulation between two sets of magnetic coils, building momentum towards more intense experiences. The 8-coil Shakti is the manufacturer's recommended system for spiritual work, and down here, this is the one for psychic work, the Shiva neural stimulation. You can get that. So you can put this thing on. You can also get out-of-body experiences. People have reported that. Whoa! And you can get out-of-body experiences if you stimulate your brain. So this is all cool. This is well and good. I think it's wonderful. And perhaps you've heard of Richard Dawkins? Yeah, yeah. The God Delusion. He wrote a book on that. He's a very famous atheist. He's an excellent biologist as well. And he wanted to experience this, and so they put him in the coil, and they cranked that baby up, but they got nothing. Interesting. Now, this is actually a guy from UC San Diego, so he's a hometown hero, V.S. Ramachandran. So what they did is they did a study on people who had temporal lobe epilepsy, so they had seizures in this part of their brain. And what he found was what other people found, which is they had religious hallucinations, but they did a more systematic study of it. They gave people different types of words, and they allowed them to choose a preference between these words. Now, normal people will prefer erotic words over religious words. If you just give them a choice, they'll choose the erotic word more quickly. But after these people have had seizures and religious hallucinations, they'll tend to pick religious words more. Seeming to suggest that people who are religious are actually the disturbed people, but people who like to dwell on erotic things are normal. I don't know, go figure. But anyway, this is one of the things that is interesting. And so he calls this thing, this part of the brain, the God module. This is the part that stirs up religious feelings or thoughts or emotions. And if we whack that thing with magnetic stimulation or, you know, give the Shakti to it, then we've got something going on. Here, I think, is the point at which you should be critical of the argument, and here's where I'm critical. Let's apply his reasoning to how I view my wife. I see my wife, and she produces activity in my visual cortex. Okay, good. Now, I can also stick an electrode in my visual cortex, or a magnetic coil back here, and stimulate my visual cortex, and I can see illusions. And perhaps I would even see portions of my wife's face, or think that I saw her. Okay? Therefore, my wife is always an illusion. If I can generate an illusion of my wife by stimulating this part of my brain, does that mean my wife doesn't exist? Not necessarily. That means I can create an illusion that my wife exists by stimulating the brain, but this says nothing whatsoever about whether my wife exists or not. You can stimulate the brain and create an illusion of God or a feeling that something's near you or a feeling that you're out of your body. That doesn't say one thing or another, logically speaking, about whether such things actually exist independent of the stimulation. We don't know. Okay, so I'm wrapping up here. I'm almost done. So, religion is not just the feeling of another presence. It's not just an out-of-body experience. It's not just ritual. It's not just a single climactic moment of faith. I would argue that religion is a lot more to this than this to people who take it seriously. So, just because activity in the brain correlates with experiences of God does not mean that God does not exist. It doesn't prove that God does exist either. I'm just defending that this doesn't tell us anything yet. Okay. So here's the conclusions. Basically, I told you about a conflict between monism and dualism, two different views of how we should view the brain and the mind. And I gave you a little bit of background to understand some of these tools that people are using to raise these questions. We looked at the issue of free will. What does modern neuroscience say about free will? If you're a monist, it will say that free will is an illusion. If you're a dualist, you'll say that free will probably is still something we don't understand. If you're a monist, you'll say that ethics are merely produced by the brain. If you're a dualist, you'll say, maybe not. And the same thing with God. So, mental functions can be produced by the brain. These include mechanisms of will, choice, perceptions of God. From this, it does not follow that free will is an illusion. I think I've said all this. So I would say this, accept the science, but don't necessarily accept the non-scientific conclusions. Be critical. Think about it. Judge for yourself. And these are other interesting topics if you guys want to talk about them. Thank you very much.
Dr. Beggs, to be prepared to keep this talk a little bit short so we can have possible questions. I also told him that Gross Martial is very used to actually interaction between the students and the professors, unlike his 300 student classes. So, don't disappoint me. Are there any questions?
Can somebody turn on the lights, please? Just
yes.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Question for Dr. Beggs.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, for the thing about the God thing.
Yeah.
When they did this experiment, so are they saying like people who have the feeling are getting their temporal lobes being stimulated? Because when you're in church or whatever, you get that feeling. There's not that magnetic thing anywhere near your head. So how could that just...
I think that's a good question. Okay, so...
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so I'll repeat the question. So the question was, if you have your temporal lobe stimulated and you experience the sensation of God, you might also experience the sensation of God if you go to church. How does that happen if there's no magnetic field here? So I would say that's a really good question. I don't know. And I think that question should be posed to the people who are promoting this view. How then do you explain it if you don't have the coil? What is it? I think what they might say is that there's abnormal wiring, or maybe you've had a seizure, and something's going on in your head, and so you're experiencing some activity there, and you interpret it as God, when really it's a form of epilepsy.
What do you
think? Okay, wait a minute. I'll answer that in a second. Yeah, you had a question.
The question was, what's your view on it? Do you think that all this indicates that there might be a God, or do you think it disproves it?
I think this stuff says nothing whatsoever about whether God or free will or anything exists. My whole point in this is just to say that there's a current trend among neuroscientists to be materialists. And from that, I think they're jumping way too quickly into the assumption that this proves that there's no God and that free will doesn't exist. And I don't think this has done it. I'm open to the idea that that might occur, but I don't think this is it. I think what this is doing is revealing biases that people have.
So would you say that free will and ethics aren't necessarily associated with God?
Oh, that's a whole different question. That's a philosophical question, I think. Whether there are, so I just pick things that, in the common knowledge, are usually associated, but I don't mean to say that they are. And somebody asked me, what do I believe? So, full disclaimer, I am a Christian. So.
Are you
sectarian? No, I'm not. No. Yeah, in the back.
So, are you saying the device they use to stimulate the side of your brain, if you stimulate another part of your brain, like you said, you can experience illusions? Have you done that?
No, I have not done that. I'm saying hypothetically you could do that. I do know people who have worked on this. I did some research at NIH, and some friends of mine were doing work on retinal prosthesis, so where you could get some kind of camera that would cause stimulation in the back of the in the visual cortex, and they reported that people would see flashes, sometimes of different colors. They would associate and form different configurations, but nothing as detailed as an illusion of my wife. No, but I'm just giving that as an example of something that you might. Yeah.
The illusions along with that, are they just visions or are they feelings?
The religious illusions that these people were talking about?
I assume that there are feelings involved with the religious ones, but the one where they stimulated like a loved one.
Were they simulated a loved one?
No. Were they stimulated part of the brain that had like memories of a loved one? Is that what he's talking about, like having illusions of his wife?
Okay. So let me mention this. So there were some experiments done a very long time ago when they were first trying to do neurosurgery, and they want to remove a section of the brain that was causing a seizure, but they didn't want to remove a section of the brain that was important for speech. Because if you come out of the operating room and you can't talk anymore, then you're going to have a lawsuit, right? So as long as we'll remove another area that maybe does something else, but at least you can't sense that deficit. So they would go in and they'd stimulate these different areas. And when they would stimulate them, what would happen is people would experience very vivid vivid memories. Like, oh, I'm now in the kitchen, and the wind is blowing, and you know, I hear the radio on in the background. Really vivid memories. So there's a guy named Wilder Penfeld who did these types, Penfield, who did these experiments. And I can put you in touch with those references. So you would get very vivid memories by just a small electrical stimulation in one region.
So it was like memories of things that had actually happened.
Yeah.
Like they were recreating.
To them, they were very vivid when they described them. Yeah. Yes?
Maybe slightly off topic. I'm wondering, when you said, we were talking about how synapses, that the more that you do something, the more it grows.
Yes.
Like in the form of habits or addiction, how would you facilitate retraining the brain so that it would not grow as much, but in fact shrink in some way?
Yeah, that's a very good subject. There's a lot of research that's done on that. One of the things in particular with addiction is that the synapses grow its thought when they're exposed to other types of neuromodulators. So there's little transmitters that are floating around. So one that seems to be key in addictive type learning is something called dopamine. So dopamine basically squirts out anytime you experience something pleasurable. And so that can, it seems, have a very powerful effect on strengthening synapses. There's a lot of work being done on trying to prevent that from happening or to reverse it. And the answer is we don't know how to do it yet. So you can train yourself, and I'm just going to tell you stuff that you already know. You can train yourself, a person can train themselves to not do something, but it's still there. The trace is still there. So this is a major, major topic, you know. But,
and then on that note as well, I mean, if you're storing memories and you're storing emotional memories, are those emotional memories more charged than, say, for example, when I'm sitting in class and I'm learning a subject?
Usually, yes. Emotional memories are very potent. They can be learned very quickly, particularly fear memories. They can be learned in one trial. Learning calculus takes more than one trial. So usually what's called declarative memory, facts, things like that, takes many trials. Motor learning, like learning how to swing a golf club, takes thousands of trials. So there's different types of learning that take different numbers of trials.
Okay, so how then does that influence free will? I mean, you know, going off of some of the things that you were saying, if you're reacting, responding to something that might be an emotional memory that's been stored and you're not quite conscious of it, how do you access
it? Oh, yeah. I mean, the issue of free will, I don't claim to have that understood at all. In fact, my view is that I think there's massive amounts of stuff that we don't understand about free will. My main critique is that these guys, if they're claiming to dissect free will, I don't buy it yet. If they're claiming that they've understood God, I don't buy it. If they claim to have understood ethics, I simply don't buy it. I think all these topics are extremely complex and deserve a lot more than just these quick attempts at like, oh, now we've got it figured out. No, I don't think so. Okay, so I agree with you. I think that these things can definitely influence free will. So if I have a powerful negative experience, it's going to be really hard for me to do the right thing. And I might not even be aware consciously of that negative experience. So I think that all these things come into play. So, and I don't know how it happens.
Just one last question.
And then I'm really cutting you off.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in some of the studies that they did with some of the spiritual and religious people, do they also then study atheists? Do the atheists have any sort of like a simulated type of, maybe if it wasn't a religious experience?
That's a good question. Some atheists have experienced religious feelings when they're stimulated in this manner. But Richard Dawkins, who is a famous atheist, didn't. So it's kind of both ways. And some religious people don't experience religious feelings when they're stimulated in this manner.
No. Listening, it appears that ethical behavior has evolved, you know, from the back to the front. You said it's a more intelligent person would make a decision in those arguments. But I kind of have a question about altruistic behavior, mm-hmm. because it's consistent. And if we're evolving our ethical beliefs on how to make a correct decision, it would seem like altruistic behavior would be lessening, because to do an altruistic behavior, you know, you're subliminating yourself to do something with no reward for it, mm-hmm. at all. So where is the altruism coming from?
That's a really good question. So for some people who might not have heard it, he's asking about where does altruism come in? You know, sacrificing yourself, you might not get anything out of it, and you would think that evolution would work against that. The answer is I don't know how the brain codes altruism. I don't know enough about that. There's been a lot of discussion in the literature of genetics on why would you have altruistic behavior if it doesn't enhance your personal fitness. And some people said, well, maybe it enhances the fitness of those who are closely related to you, and maybe in that way some fraction of your gene goes on, even if your particular genes don't go on. So this is hotly debated, and it's not settled yet. It's not. But I agree with you. That's certainly something that is not, it's not easy to visualize, but it's clear. Yeah?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're just, like you're a Christian and you believe in God, only because you're still skeptical that it hasn't been proven wrong yet.
Oh.
And you kind of feel like it's on the verge of things, like whatever.
Oh, no, no. I don't think it's on the verge of things. I think the popular opinion is that it's already been proven. Most people believe this, I think. And certainly in academic circles, most people embrace this view. I don't embrace the view. I would say that we should be more critical of it and skeptical of it. Hopefully, I'm doing that on a scientific basis, but I realize that I can't always trust myself. So I do have a vested interest in Christianity, but I'm hopefully open to the idea. For example, if you came to me with evidence that Jesus was a fake, and that somehow this was all faked, and it was good evidence, I mean really solid evidence, better than the evidence that we currently have, I would have to go with you. All right? Now, I have personal experiences of God and so forth, and those would be hard for me to completely give up, but if I'm really rational, I can't, I've got to go with where the truth lies, right? I've got to seek truth first.
Right.
I can't be locked into some kind of view and no matter what, I'm going to do this. No. Well, at least I don't believe that. That's my view. Yeah?
I had a question about the synapses again.
Sure.
We're saying that if its threshold is 100 and less than 100 fire, is that something that Ritalin or something drugs can be made?
Ah, yeah.
Synapses fire,
yeah, that,
threshold lower? Or?
That's a really good question. So one of the things that Ritalin does is it basically overexcites things. You'd think it wouldn't, right? You'd think it would calm people down, right? But what it does is it overexcites things, and one idea is that that then kicks in the brain's self-regulating mechanism, which says, whoa, now we're really too excited, and its self-regulating mechanism causes it to come down. So with most physiological things like blood pressure, breathing rate, heart rate, body temperature, pH, etc., you have a homeostatic range in which your body tries to keep it in that range. If you're out of that range, things go bad. So if you perhaps become overexcited in a neural sense, then these mechanisms could kick in. Truth is, we don't understand. Most drugs, we don't know why they work. We have no idea why they work. They've been discovered by accident, and we're trying to fix that, but we don't know how they work. We just know that, I mean, someone could say, oh yeah, antidepressants work because they stop the reuptake of serotonin. But let's ask another, well then why does, you know, changing serotonin level change your mood? Well, I don't know. We don't know. I mean, one more question and we're at the cliff of ignorance. You know, so we don't know that. That's a good question. Yeah?
Would that be your time on agreement? Why, if someone has, like, ADD with the child that calms down, but if I don't have ADD and I take it, it keeps
yeah, it lets you study for hours. Right, yeah, so what it would do, under this theory, yeah, you're down here, you're not close to the threshold of being over. A person who's got ADHD, you give them Ritalin, they're over here, and the brain says, no, it goes down. But you're maybe here, well within the normal range, and you take Ritalin, and now you're up here. Perhaps, that's an idea. I'm not an expert in Ritalin, but I'm just telling you one theory of how it might work.
But I always thought that was kind of weird, but the thing you were telling her kind of makes that different effect.
Yeah, so it's a state-dependent effect. It depends on the state of your system when you give that drug. You had a question?
In response to the question on health,
yeah,
there is such a thing called the selfish gene theory.
Called what? The selfish gene?
Selfish gene theory.
Yeah.
Which relates to it in case the original aspect was separated. And my question is, since you are, for instance, like you believe that theories that haven't been proven wrong, still deserve credit. Are you aware of, say, Russell's Teapot, the school of pastafarianism? And if so,
yeah. Yeah. The flying spaghetti monster. Sure. Yeah. So I'm open to talking about those types of things too. But probably in order to keep it on topic, I'd be happy to talk with you afterwards about it. Yeah, I enjoy those topics. That'd be great. Yeah?
Kind of going along with what you're saying about how we have, you know, pills and drugs that alter our moods, do you think there will ever be kind of a pill that we can take to completely X out our psychological need or want for to believe into some God, and do you think there'd be a market for that?
I like your style. This is good. Yeah, well, I wouldn't buy it, but I think that, yeah, there is a felt need. I wouldn't deny that. I think most people feel a need for some kind of comforting father-type figure. I won't deny that. I think that's definitely there. but I also have a need for other things that I wouldn't want to erase. Like, would I want to take a pill that would completely erase my craving for pizza? And that would mean I'd never have a juicy pizza again. I don't know that I'd want to do that.
Well, maybe you would, but you wouldn't enjoy it as much because...
Yeah, yeah. Right. Now we're kind of talking about the Matrix, right? You know, where Cypher says, yeah, give it to me, man. Give it the juicy stuff. I don't care if it's not real. You know, he's got the electrodes in his head, and he just wants the illusion. I think that we'll always be driven by satisfying our desires. And you can either satisfy them, which is sort of what we do today in this world, or you can try to annihilate your desires. I guess that's Buddhism in a nutshell. You know, they're both strategies, yeah. There would be a market for it, I think. Some people would go for it. Yeah. Yeah, sure, in the back. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. How noble of you. How altruistic. Yes, go ahead.
Well, thanks. I just wondered, you said how when utilitarian function came up, it was in a higher cognitive part of the brain. And you could see that it was more highly evolved. Well, I wanted to know that when it was the emotional area of the brain, does that seem to have stopped evolving? Is it the same as, let's say, in a primate where I...
Oh, yeah, that's...
Has it evolved too, or has it stopped evolving? Is it going away?
Yeah, yeah. Now, okay, so hopefully you guys could hear that. Is the emotional area of the brain still evolving, or is it not evolving? And the answer is it's almost certainly still evolving. It's almost certainly changing. So one of the key areas that are involved in that is involved in emotion in the brain is the amygdala. The amygdala in humans is notably different from the amygdala in rats, for example. So even though that's a very primitive area of the brain that was laid down, some people would say, way before reptiles even came around, that area is still undergoing changes. Absolutely.
Why would it be this area? The front part of our brain, the cortex, where we get the cognitive function from, and the utilitarianism, you know,
right,
be based upon that. Where then could you also make an argument for deontologists that say, well, no, we also are evolving as emotional creatures, as an altruistic creature as well.
That's a very good idea. I hadn't thought of that. I think, do you mind if I use it? So that's it. I can't ask you another question. Anyone over here? Yeah, you.
Okay, I have one.
Oh, right. Okay. Hold on for a second, though. Let me... Yeah, go ahead.
The readiness with this one, right, on that one study where it wrote for the consciousness of the choice.
Yes.
What is that the result of?
The readiness potential?
Right.
What is it? That's a really good question. I don't think it's fully understood.
So if it's not fully understood, even the things that composite that aren't fully understood, and then you can reduce it all the way down to neutrons, protons, and whatever else, electrons, and then you don't have to fully understand those, so you can't really reduce that all the way. And it kind of goes along with your argument, but you'll never actually be able to fully understand everything and say that there can't be something else, that there can't be, you know, soul or God that... as a part of that, you know, even if you did know every single, you know...
Oh, I see what you're... Yeah.
You had empirical... Every single bit of empirical evidence you could get, you wouldn't be able to say that there isn't something else that we don't know that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's kind of... But, you know, you said that... You know, to counter that, you said that it wasn't... That to say that God doesn't exist doesn't logically follow from the evidence that they have about the, you know, the surface tests and all that, that, you know, with the... You know, the image scanners, you know, or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
It almost does logic. I mean, if you're looking for, you know, it's followed deductively,
mm-hmm,
it's not going to, right? But, you know, inductively, it's more probable that he doesn't, or she doesn't, or, you know, whatever else.
Okay, so no, well, what I would say is that you have to be careful. Evidence is not, it's not nothing, right? I'm not trying to just sweep it under the rug. What I'm saying is that we should also be careful to investigate these phenomena by other means other than the brain. So take the example that I gave of my wife, all right? So maybe if you stimulate my visual cortex, I have illusions of parts of my wife or maybe part of her face or something like that. Okay, the question of whether my wife exists or not should be answered by going to my house and taking pictures or, you know, something like that, and not by stimulating my brain and seeing what pops up. So I think that this evidence is perhaps relevant, but perhaps it's not. And there's certainly another avenue which is much more direct that should be pursued. That's my main argument for it.
Which avenue would that be? To find God?
To find God?
That's what they're arguing, right?
I'll tell you what my...
Yeah, but...
So what my argument would be, in order to investigate whether God exists or not, I would look at things like... how did everything get here? Was there a definite point in time and space where all matter and all time and all energy and all space had an origin? If it did, what was the force or the agent that might have initiated that? What are the characteristics of that agent? I would investigate things like that. Okay? So I would go into that, and I think that's, you know, and this thing that set things up, what are the rules that it set up, and did these rules allow for the universe to be intelligible? Did the rules allow for the universe to evolve into a complex state or not? What are the odds that we would get rules that would lead to a complex state of affairs? What are the odds that we would get rules that would lead to a non-complex state of affairs? I would pursue it by that method. I mean, I can stimulate and get all kinds of things out of my brain. And when I was a college student, I did stimulate and got all kinds of things out of my brain, right? And so, you know, what does that tell me? What's real or not? That's like the last place you want to do is go down the rabbit hole and say, wow, the Red Queen is talking to me. That's not going to tell you what's real. I think what's going to tell you what's real is let's take a view that let's see what's out there, not necessarily what's in here. What's in here is not nothing, but it's not everything. That's all I'm saying. Does that make sense? You don't have to.
I mean, for scientists to study those kinds of things, it just doesn't seem like it's possible to ever understand how the beginning of the world originated, except with theories. So I mean.
Oh no! I would say within the last 100 years, we've made enormous strides in understanding cosmology and understanding.
You think enough to understand how the world started and whether there's the first cause or whether there wasn't. I mean.
Oh no, we don't have those things settled, but. Think of this. In the early 1900s, it was thought that the universe didn't have an origin, that it was just kind of always here. And then when Hubble saw the redshift on these galaxies and they extrapolated things back, they said, oh, everything's got to have started at one point. That was, I think, the most monumental discovery of the 20th century, was that there was indeed an origin to all space, all time, all matter, all energy. Everything had a point of beginning. There was truly a beginning. All physicists would admit that. No one's going to deny that. That's completely different from what was, before 1900. So I don't know what's going to come next. There's all kinds of stuff out there, string theory, etc. But I don't know if you've also heard of the anthropic argument. So if you change the ratio, well, basically, in very simple terms, if the universe had exploded just a little bit too hard, then everything would have spaced out and no interesting coalescences would have formed. You wouldn't have had stars, you wouldn't have had planets. If the universe had shot out a little bit too weakly, just a very tiny bit too weakly, 1 over 10 to the 120th power too weakly, that's a very small number, everything would have collapsed too quickly and you wouldn't have had interesting coalescences kind of hanging out and orbiting each other and star formation. There's even Steven Weinberg, who is just completely against this idea, said the cosmological constant is very, very oddly tuned or oddly resting at a particular value that allows all this to happen. If we're bumped up by, 1.000001, too strong or too weak, none of this would be here. It wouldn't be that things would just be different. Nothing would be here that would be interesting. That's weird. That's like standing in front of a firing squad and having all these people shoot at you, and they're all expert marksmen, and on that particular day, everyone misses you. Now, you could conclude that you just got lucky, or you might think, maybe there's something going on. Maybe they decided not to shoot me today. And it's your choice. There's not a conclusive way to prove it one way or the other. But I think that line of reasoning is a lot more interesting than taking a big magnetic coil, sticking it next to my head and going, woo, 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 and suddenly I feel like maybe there's a person near me. I don't think that tells us a whole lot. That's my view. But, I see your point too. Yes?
Yeah, I have two questions. The first was on the experiment footbridge.
Yes.
Why was the individual only given the option of pushing the other person off instead of jumping off themselves?
That's a very good point. Right. That's a very good point. I don't know why. I actually talked with Joshua Green at his poster when he presented a few years ago. And I can ask him that if I see him at the conference.
Self-preservation versus altruism.
Yeah, that could be it. Yeah.
My second question was regarding the readiness potential to sustain the world's moves.
Yeah.
Possibly reflecting the action potential of the neurons necessary to make the decision, the conscious decision to move.
It could be. Now, the thing is, it's hard to know because you're filtering the signal through the skull. And so to really do that, what you'd have to do is open up the skull and lower electrodes in, which I haven't been given permission to do yet, but I think that would be the way to go. If you could, or there might be some future way of visualizing human neurons in real time.
They were just measuring activity. They didn't know from precisely which area.
Yeah, they didn't know. But almost certainly it's caused by action potentials. Yes, almost certainly. Yeah?
I kind of want to comment on the guy that got the pole shoved through his...
Yes, pole. Phineas Gage.
Right. Kind of the whole debate between nature versus nurture. Jekyll and Hyde, or Frankenstein. You know, Frankenstein started good and society made him bad. Or Jekyll and Hyde, we're all actually evil. It's just the filter that God has given us that we are primitive prop. That you might suggest that ethics do exist outside of our mind if, as soon as he loses his ability to filter all the garbage that's in his head, it just all spills out. Even though that garbage that he's spilling out could not be evil if we had taught him that, butter was really a swear word.
Ah, interesting.
Life,
okay.
Then he'd be spewing out butter instead of the F word or whatever.
Right.
That if... That kind of proves in a way that even though we have the ability to filter all that stuff, what's actually there isn't pure and good like we like to think of ourselves. And that fits right in with a lot of religious views, Christianity, obviously. Whatever. So I thought that was very interesting, just to comment on that could very well prove, not prove anything, but disprove a lot of claims that were naturally good when he loses that ability to filter.
Yeah, I see your point. I don't know that I would... Yeah, okay, so the experiment would be to raise somebody in an environment where butter was a swear word, then blow a pole through their head, and then see what happens. Right. Yeah. Okay. Now I see.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah, let's get funding for that. No. But I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
As far as the pushing somebody over or sacrificing yourself, if you go to any parent and you would say, you know, if there's a group of people and you have the choice of sacrificing yourself or your only son, who would you pick? Almost 90% of the time, I guess, at least, they pick themselves. Oh, I'll sacrifice myself with my firstborn son to save all these people, no problem. That would be, as far as Christianity goes, why God sacrificed his only son. Like, that's such a against the grain decision for us, that our emotion kicks in and it's, I would sacrifice myself over anything else to save people. Well, logically, what's a bigger sacrifice than yourself is your only firstborn son. Same with Jacob.
Well, for me, that would be an even bigger problem if I'm Roman Catholic and we're taught that, you know, suicide, regardless of the reason, is a cardinal sin.
So it might depend a lot on how you're taught, what you're brought up with. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Let me ask you haven't had a chance.
So do you conclude that neuroscience has no room for questions about God then? Is that your main...
I hadn't thought about that. I just thought about defending. No, I think in principle neuroscience could comment on God. I just don't think that these studies have done that yet. I think that... it would take a while for me to think, but I'm open to the idea that it could. I'm open to any evidence that could make a comment on any of these things. I'm just saying that I'm not convinced by these experiments that they're saying anything conclusive about these issues.
So you think that Green and Cohen suggest that they found the area that is necessary to have a feeling of God? Is that what they're concluding?
Oh, no. I think what they suggested in the review was that the more evolved areas of the brain, although the guy had a very good point that, you know, your emotional areas are still evolving too, that those higher, more evolved areas are the ones that kick in when you make a utilitarian decision, and that therefore that's a superior decision to something that relies on the emotional areas of the brain. I think they're basically trying to tell us what's right and wrong based on knowledge of how the brain works. And I don't think knowledge of how the brain works is completely useless in that respect. I just don't think that their analysis of it is convincing to me. So you could ask this: who would you rather have as a neighbor when you're in distress? Someone who's a utilitarian or a deontologist, someone who has emotion or compassion for you, or someone who basically says, I got to get to work. You know, I'd rather have someone who has emotion and compassion. Who do you think would raise better children? Probably parents who have emotion and compassion. So I'm not convinced that just because the prefrontal cortex shows this type of activity, that that's always the best thing. I think sometimes it's the best thing, and I think sometimes utilitarian decisions are probably the best thing to do. I'm just not convinced that they're always best and that that's the best region of the brain. So...
responses in the brain with the morality decision to push the person or to let the five people die that showed activity in both the moral parts and the...
Yeah, okay, very good point. So what happened was, I kind of oversimplified, and they did too, but the truth is that there is kind of an overlap. But what happens is, the areas that were mostly emotional were the ones that lit up in the footbridge dilemma, whereas the areas that were mostly cognitive were the ones that lit up in the switch dilemma.
So I guess that would kind of correlate with people who were like, yeah, push them off really quickly versus someone who thinks about it for a long time?
Could be, yeah. That you'd have to do a separate study to determine that, but that's a reasonable hypothesis, I think. Yeah. Yeah?
I was just wondering, have there been any studies or any of your studies or anything like that shown that in the brain that the empiricist or rationalist, like knowledge is already in the brain?
Sure. Okay, so there's the idea of empiricism versus rationalism. So there are a couple comments on that. So there's a guy named Oliver Sacks who writes lots of books. One of his books' titles is The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. So he talks about people who have brain lesions. And one of the things that Oliver Sacks did is he wrote a piece for The New Yorker that talked about a person who couldn't see during the first part of his life because he had cloudy lenses. And then what happened was that somehow they were able to remove the cloudiness in his lenses and they thought he would be able to see. And so this is one of the things that John Locke brought up. And John Locke was one of the early empiricists. He said, look, if you were able to basically take a blind person and then suddenly show them a pyramid and show them a sphere, just by looking at them, they should be able to tell what they are because they've already had some kind of sense of touch and things like that. So he was the guy who believed in this blank slate, and then somehow by sensory experience you imprint these things, and once you get the knowledge, then you're able to detect these things. And it turned out that this guy, once they cleared up his lenses, he couldn't see that well. And what happened was his brain had developed in such a way so as to depend on tactile information and auditory information and olfactory information that he really didn't depend on his vision very much. And perhaps for that reason, the synapses involved in that never became very developed. And so he had matured and his synapses were much less plastic as an older adult, and he couldn't relearn that stuff. And so he really couldn't see. And so the title of the article is To See and Not See. And so that's one thing that kind of comments on this. Another real brief point I'll make, because I see John hovering, is that if you believe that we're mostly driven by sensory input, then you would believe that our system largely depends on connections coming from the senses into the brain. But if you're more of a rationalist, then what you believe is that we have more connections within our brain than we have connections coming in. So we know the answer to that. We know about the balance of incoming sensory connections versus the proportion of connections that are within our brain. And the answer is we've got far more connections within our brain for the signal kicking around in here than we have for the stuff coming in. In fact, it's outnumbered by about 10 to 1 in the visual system. So the feedback connections going back in the other direction are 10 times more numerous than the incoming connections. So it seems like there's a lot of kicking around of the stimulus once it gets into the head. It's not like this direct readout. The senses tell you to do something. It's definitely not like that. So, but that's a really good question. It's a classical question. So I think John is...
I was going to say, I find it interesting that neuroscience and John Locke and David Hume and Immanuel Kant, they all kind of can maybe talk to each other a bit, although those guys are all dead, I guess. But Dr. Beggs is going to hang out for a few minutes. I know some of you want to have a bit more personal questions, but we'll give him a bit of a break and say thank you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
A little bit of food left. How's the time to come out together?
Not much, but... Yes. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you said you can simulate your visual cortex and have the illusion of your wife.
Well, no, you can have certain visual percepts that would be...
Like that you've already had a basis for, right? Like memories, you've already experienced that. So for
you could conceivably do that, yeah.
In order for somebody to experience God, wouldn't they already have to have like a basis for what God is for them to experience that? And most people can agree that we haven't really seen God.
Yeah, yeah.
That we haven't really seen God. Do you think that these experiences are being like misconstrued as religious when they're like some other kind of pleasure? Or?
They might be. That's possible. But that argument would also say that I would never know what green jello is unless I had previously experienced it. And I'm pretty sure I hadn't previously experienced it. So somehow we're able to construct things.
But like you have a visual basis for what green jello looks like. If somebody,
but when I first saw it, how did I know what it was? Right. So I think that.
Know what God is?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Quick question. Where did you go to school?
I went to Cornell as an undergrad and studied physics, then I went to Yale and studied neuroscience. So,
how many years did you go to
school? Way too many. I started my undergraduate work in 1981, and then I actually got a master's in engineering in like 1986. Then I went into the Peace Corps, and I taught high school for 2 years in Western Samoa. Really tough assignment, coconuts, beaches. And then I entered graduate school in 1990, and I finished in 1998. And then I did a postdoctoral fellowship from 1999 to 2003. And then in 2003, I got a job as an assistant professor. So it's a long, long haul of stuff. But I love it. I love my job. I love to do this. I love hearing questions.
What's the purpose of your study? Are you just analyzing how the brain functions? Or?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're trying to take a little chunk of cortex, that bark, that outer sheet, and we're trying to figure out how it processes information. And so one of the things that we're doing is we're able to take ideas from physics that describe how collections of molecules behave. So it's a branch of physics called statistical mechanics. And you can say, if this describes how ensembles of molecules behave, can it then describe how ensembles of brain cells behave? So we're taking these ideas from physics and putting it in here. Now, in statistical mechanics, you look at things like the pressure, the temperature, something called the specific heat, and so forth. But in a neural network, you can look at information-related quantities, like how much information does it store, how well does it transmit information, how well does it compute. And so what we're trying to do is develop a theory that allows us to look at these things in the spirit of statistical mechanics and looking at a little chunk. Now, this little chunk can go bad. It can have seizures, it can sometimes underperform, and we want to figure out how we can fix it. So what we also do, and what I didn't talk about, is we get slices of human brain from patients up at Indianapolis, children who have epilepsy surgery. So if they have intractable epilepsy and drugs will not cause their epilepsy to go away or at least be managed, then they go in and they do surgery and they cut out a little region of the brain that's thought to be originating these seizures. It's called a focus. They take that and we catch it in a beaker, we run to our electrode array, we put it on, and we record the activity there. And so we can see what happens when activity spreads in a piece of brain that is somehow pathological. And we can try to understand, is there any way that we can take this pathological piece of brain and bring it back to sort of a normal level, yeah, homeostasis, yeah. So we try to study this thing. So hopefully our work is very basic in research. It's not directly applied, but we're hoping that we have a new slant on things like epilepsy, and if we're right, then perhaps it would lead to something like a breakthrough. But if you ever want breakthroughs, you certainly can't always do applied research. Applied research will only extend what we already know. If you want to discover something new that might revolutionize the field, you have to invest in basic research that has no immediate known payoff. But the idea is the more we understand this, then maybe the better we can think of a shortcut for fixing it. So that's kind of what we're doing.
Where are you studying through these experiments?
At Indiana University in the physics department.
So what brought you here?
I know John Oakes, so we're personal friends. And I was coming into town for the neuroscience conference, which starts in a couple days. And he said, hey, John, why don't you come over and give a talk? And I said, I'd love to. And I was particularly interested. And he said, these students are very interactive. I'm like, you guys are way more interactive than the students that I'm used to. You guys are asking a lot of questions, which is fabulous. So this is good.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me.
Question.
Yeah.
I got an impression.
Was there a signature for honors?
Which class
meeting? Yeah. I admitted that. I admitted that. And you, hopefully that's a disclaimer so that you can judge for yourself whether this makes sense or not.
What's your name?
Brianna.
Oh, Brianna Gomez?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So,
maybe recreating
the
idea that
we're
the
Yeah.
We can't really know for sure if that's the same feeling that people who are actually having these feelings.
Yeah, and, sure, right.
And on the other end of the spectrum, I'm looking at things like anthropic principle and, you know, say that if the world is even, you know, a billionth of a percent different from the universe, then there wouldn't even be people to ask questions like this. But I think like with both arguments, all you can really do is say, oh, that's interesting. And, I mean, do you think it's even...
No, I don't know. I don't feel that way about the anthropic principle. I feel that... So here's the issue. In science, we typically say that something is significant if it's deemed to be highly unlikely to have been caused by chance. Then we say, ah, that's a phenomenon, and that deserves further investigation. And so what it now looks like is if you were to take all the rules of the universe, like the mass of the electron, the charge of the electron, the cosmological constant, etc., and put them all kind of in a rack of dice, and then randomly add numbers to them or subtract numbers to them, and then put that down, and then run a simulation and see what happens to the universe. If you were to do that and play chance with all the constants in the universe, what you'd end up with is junk, almost always. Only once would you hit it just right.
Pretty much.
And so then the question...
mass or gases everywhere that never...
Yeah, exactly. It would be just almost always nothing interesting. And so the question is that statistically significant? Is it highly unlikely that we are in the state of affairs that we're in right now? And the answer is overwhelmingly yes. And in traditional science, if something is more rare than 1 in 20, in other words, if it has a p-value less than 0.05, you declare it significant, you publish it. Well, the p-value for this, you know, billions, you know, it's off the charts.
Would you say it's conclusive?
Well, now the second question is, how do you interpret that? How do we interpret it? That's what we don't know. But whether it's significant or not, it absolutely is significant. And so what that means is that something non-random is at work here. That's what that means. What that is a subject of, now we get into philosophy.
Okay.
And I can't prove anything. Yeah, sure.
As a very well-educated believer in God, mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible to prove that God exists?
I go back and forth on that. I don't know. I think that what I think is that it's possible... In many cases, let's leave God out of the picture for now. It's possible for people to believe all kinds of strange things when the evidence is very, very clearly against them. Okay? So why do we do silly things like continue to smoke when we know that it causes lung cancer? Why do we do that? Why do we...
I couldn't tell you.
You know, there's all kinds of irrational behavior that we engage in, right? We're not rational beings. Okay, so I have been in cases where we're not talking about God, but the evidence for something is just overwhelming in a particular case, and someone doesn't want to believe it. And the reason they don't want to believe it, I suspect, is because it's threatening to them, or it means that they'll have to change their life in some way, or it means that their previous work was wrong. This erupts in science all the time, right? You know, so why is it that... Millikan, the guy who determined the charge on the electron, wouldn't listen to the idea that he was wrong about cosmic rays. When the evidence was overwhelming, why wouldn't he listen? Why wouldn't he buy it? Why did people reject the idea of continental drift for so long when the evidence was quite good? Why do they do that?
Dr. Biggs, I'm sorry, I want to introduce myself. I'm Dr. Yang.
Oh, hi.
PhD in philosophy.
Oh, great, wonderful.
I loved what you said about philosophy. I wanted to ask you a question.
Oh, sure. Wow.
I thought the students, oh, no, not now. I have to actually take off.
Okay, well,
but it was
thanks for coming.
Pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for visiting us.
Oh, I...
Students really enjoyed
it. I loved it. I'd love to come back. Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for saying hi. Yeah, sure. So I think that, you know, people engage in all kinds of beliefs that are not necessarily rational. And so let's imagine this scenario. If the evidence were for God was completely compelling.
But non-conclusive?
No, let's say it was conclusive. Let's say it was as good as the evidence that people had for arguing that Millikan was wrong about cosmic rays. You'd still have a large number of people who wouldn't believe it.
You mean like Flat Earth Society?
Like the what? Flat Earth? Yeah, exactly. You still have pockets of people who believe certain things for reasons that can't be fully explained by the proof, the evidence, whatever. So I don't know. I think for me personally, there's a lot of evidence that strongly suggests that God exists. Then I took a step on that, and then I began to feel like there was something going on that reaffirm my belief. And so now I'm on that path. Okay? But to be open-minded about it, I think, you know, if someone doesn't step on that path, then they're not going to start to see the things that I claim to have seen. Now, to me personally, they're compelling. But I can't take my personal experience and then import it into somebody else, or, you know, inject it into someone else's life. Do you ever see the movie Contact?
Of course.
Yeah. I thought that was amazing. And Carl Sagan is not a theist, but I think he put the point really well. So this Jodie Foster character has this personal experience of being transported, you know, faster than light to another place. But she comes back, and now she's in the position of a believer. She's got a deep personal experience that she's convinced was true, but she's not able to communicate it by external evidence to other people. And she's a scientist put in that position. How deeply ironic. I mean, I think it was just brilliant that he did this. You know, I mean, for Carl Sagan to do something, I mean, in a way, it was almost saying he could understand people who had religious beliefs. He was that open-minded, I think, to say it. But you know, I think it's... At the moment, I don't know if there's compelling... For me, it's enough. And I think for most people, it should be enough. But I realize...
The planet is religious, isn't it? Give and take.
It's a large percentage, but I would also question what real religion is. So, like, someone just could say, what religion am I? Well, I guess I'm Christian. My mom and dad were Christians. I'm probably Christian. Is that real religion? I don't know. I mean, that's kind of like saying, what football team do you root for? You know, it's just kind of what you're born into. It's not a big decision. I would say you got to really think about it before it's an authentic choice. But that's my opinion. I realize I could be wrong about a lot of stuff, so...
There's a huge thing I'd love to comment on, that whole idea of can God be proved? Because there's that feeling that people, you know, they want proof one way or another because it has such massive consequences one way or another.
And that's true.
You know, that's why we all, every single person on this planet, comes to that moment where, hey, I need to make a decision about this, you know, and I want...